Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Good day, this is Daniel Parkinson. I'm back for another installment of the Gay Mormon Stories. Today I have an interesting podcast planned that I think you're going to find really inspiring and interesting. I'm starting this interview with two brothers, Jefferson Cloward and Nathan Cloward. I have been kind of inadvertently familiar with this family for some time because they're all pretty active bloggers. But it turns out that Jefferson's story came to my attention on his blog called Accidental Atheist, where he talked about his leaving Mormonism. But more importantly to this podcast, or maybe not more, but equally important to this podcast, is the fact that his father is gay, and he wrote a little bit about how that impacted him. Later on, for some reason, I started following another blog of his sort of independently without even realizing it was the same person, which is called Weekend Philanthropist, which is a really great blog that talks about ways he gets involved locally in philanthropy or in good deeds. And I really like the blog because it really gives accessible ideas about how to participate in your community and how to do good things. And so I really have enjoyed following that. And then at some point I also heard his mother, not heard his mother, but read his mother's blog about her experience with leaving the church on the heels of both her sons leaving the church. And so at one point, I kind of put together that all these people are in the same family, or that Jefferson's the same person as both these blogs, and then I got a chance to talk with him and Nathan. So that sort of sums up how I connected with these guys, and I just decided that it would be interesting to get their perspective on growing up in this context, being the children in a family that was a mixed orientation marriage, and also I like to highlight stories that are interesting, not just because they're Gay Mormon stories, but because they're really interesting stories. And these guys certainly qualify. And we also have another element, is that Kevin Klusterman, one of my co-hosts here at Gay Mormon Stories, is actually going to do an interview with each of their parents, their biologic parents, that is, which is Curtis Cloward and Rhea Walton. So it's going to kind of give you not the complete story of their family, because there's other family members who have really interesting stories too, and I really wish I could have included them all. But anyway, they all have super interesting stories, and it's an amazing family, and I think you're going to be really interested in hearing all the parts of this podcast that are going to kind of come out in a series. So let's start. Who wants to introduce themselves first? Do we go older to younger or younger to older?
I guess we'll go younger to older. My name's Jefferson, Jefferson Cloward, and I'm just really excited to be a part of this. I've been kind of observing the Mormon stories and listening to other podcasts throughout this time, and so really excited for this. I don't know what else you'd like me to say, but
well, you're going to say a lot.
You already kind of explained the blogs, and
yeah, no, we're going to talk a lot more about that. So I guess it's a tough introduction when I don't want you to give away all of what's coming. But let's just, why don't you say a howdy, Nathan, too, and why don't you guys, you could just tell us where you live and minor details like that, what you do for a living.
Yeah, this is Nathan. Hopefully everybody can tell the difference between our voices here eventually, but just really excited to be involved here. I've been following Mormon Stories for a long time, looking forward to seeing where Gay Mormon Stories goes and all the good that it does. We're currently down in Austin, Texas. We're pursuing different plans up in Utah, and then just kind of came together and decided we wanted to come down and start a business together. We've always kind of dreamt of working together on various things, so we're down here going to be starting a business in fencing sales and installation, and having a good time down here right now.
Well, I really really like to see tight family connections, and you guys are obviously really tight with all your families, but you're also really united as brothers, and so that's a really great starting point for our podcast, just the fact that I'm able to interview both at the same time. And so, you know, I'm going to start youngest to oldest too. I think that Jefferson's, like I say, your blog post gave me my first introduction to your story. as the son of a gay man. But this is also Mormon Stories. And so if you don't mind just giving a small background of your family and their Mormon heritage. And actually, both of you guys, why don't you guys just each pipe in on this part, since this is absolutely shared between both of you.
Yeah, absolutely. We started out in Utah. I was born in Utah. Mormons for generations, I guess. We have three sisters and then us two in our immediate family. And I'm the youngest in the family, so just a short kind of history of where we went. My parents were divorced when I was 1 year old. Later, my mom moved down to Texas with all of us and there met our to-become stepdad, David. And then later we all moved back to Utah. So we have also stepbrothers, kind of a large family. There's nine of us kids all together in the whole network of things.
Well, anyway, let's go back to the very start. So your family was pretty thick Mormon. I mean, both your parents, all your grandparents, all your aunts and uncles. I mean, this was absolutely Mormon family, right?
Yeah, very much so. And all of our extended family and everything. You know, I went to high school in Davis High, which is the largest seminary, LDS seminary in the world. And so really surrounded by Mormonism in Utah. And yeah, most of our family members are in Utah and very religious. So
okay.
Just going back on kind of our family history, our mom is the oldest of nine kids. Her parents are they were converted to the church when she was young, I believe close to baptism age, and moved to Kaysville. Our grandpa, her father, was in the Air Force and then became a pilot for UPS. And so since their conversion, the whole family has been very involved in the church. Right now, it's a very diverse group. A lot of people have left the church. A lot of people are still kind of in and out. And then there are still many that are TBM Mormons right now.
Which I'll define for the listeners who may not know that a TBM is a shorthand for a true believing member or a true blue Mormon. Or it's just a fast way of typing someone who really truly believes.
Yeah, I'll try to eliminate the acronyms that I'm used to on Mormon
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
As far as our dad's side, comes from a very long tradition in the Mormon church. He's the youngest of four kids. And on both sides, our grandma and grandpa's families, they're descendants of pioneers. In fact, our great-great, I'm not sure how many greats, but one of our great-grandfathers, Thomas P. Cloward, actually traveled to Utah with Brigham Young and was there with him. And his name is etched on the memorial there in Temple Square.
Okay.
It's a long tradition there on that side particularly, but both sides coming from, you know, definitely from the LDS upbringing and all of our cousins and friends and everything being raised in Utah, we were very close with the church.
Yeah, okay. Your background sounds not too terribly different from mine, actually. I'm also a total Utah inbred Mormon. Since I know both of your parents are actually going to be telling this story of their experience with all of this, it's okay if we end up repeating some of the elements because you're going to give a very different viewpoint. But since I'm starting with Jefferson, we're going to jump in a little bit into Nathan's experience because he's a little older. But Jefferson, because your blog post kind of talked about the events surrounding your birth, I just think that's all really relevant to your story. So why don't you start by retelling me that?
Yeah, absolutely.
About your coming into this world.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a unique kind of a birth story. You know, it was towards the end of my parents' relationship. They were not exactly intimate at the time, but my mom had a dream in which a young grown man came to her, blonde hair, blue eyes, and asked if he could come to the earth. And so my mom woke up. It was a very spiritual experience for her. And so they did have another child, which was me. Knew I was going to be a boy from before I came into the story. And so that was kind of the unlikely birth.
Furthermore, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy.
Yeah. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy.
So you kind of grew up with this narrative. I mean, this is not something she kept secret from the family. This is something she was open about with you and your family, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but talk a little bit about, you know, then your childhood and maybe even the context of this dream and how it impacted both your childhood and your youth, but also talk a little bit about your Mormon experience.
Yeah, so knowing that I was in this or believing that I was in this family for a specific reason affected me in a large way, in that I asked myself why it was important. And the obvious and first answer to that question was because I was here for my dad. My parents were divorced when I was one. I wasn't really around my dad very much, except for one time a year or so and Christmas cards, and that was about it. But he was my dad, and I felt that I was supposed to be his son in order to help him return to the church and return to God. So that's one way in which it affected me. Also, just my sisters. I had one sister who had left the church or wasn't very far into it in the first place anyway, but she left the church when she was younger. And so that also was, I felt a personal mission to be faithful, to really study, really apply myself, because I was meant to be here for them.
Yeah. But overall, was your Mormon childhood fairly intensely Mormon, or was your parents' divorce kind of make it some separation from the community, like happens to a lot of divorced single mothers?
No, I never felt that. It's one of the things that I'm grateful for of having grown up in the church, is that I had father figures all the time. I was just going through some keepsakes actually this last week and found a little note from a priesthood leader from when we had just moved into a ward that said, you know, if you have any questions about fishing or any of this kind of stuff, feel free to ask me. And so we always had that growing up, and we're always involved. Also, my mom married David, our stepdad, when I was 12. And so we had a normal family as far as that went after a while.
But meanwhile, throughout your childhood, you had really limited contact with your father.
Yeah. Didn't really feel that close, because he was in another estate, another state completely. And so we'd only see him once a year or so.
Yeah.
But I didn't really know that much about him or who he was. I just knew that he was my dad.
I assume your older sisters had more of a connection from having been raised by him, and even Nathan a little bit more than you, who he left when you were one, right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have any memories that they would have had. So all I knew about him was when I came into the picture as a thinking person, three or four, when he was just coming around every once in a while. So,
but all through this time, you sort of have this lingering thought in the back of your head that you really needed to at least bring him back to the church. I mean, obviously you didn't have this fantasy of reuniting your parents because your mother had remarried, but you still really felt like your purpose for living, a lot of your purpose was really to save them, really.
Yeah, I'd say it hit me really hard when I was about 14 years old. You know, as a member of the church, especially as a young member of the church, I think every new generation is taught that we are a chosen generation, and especially with the belief in the second coming, you know, a belief that this is might be the final generation before Christ comes. So there was all that around me already, and a belief that I was chosen to come at this time. But then especially being chosen to come to this family, it was kind of took that to the next level.
Yeah.
And I remember very vividly one day I was reading the scriptures. I was about 14 years old. I was reading the Old Testament with a study guide. I was in my front room, had the Bible on the coffee table, and came across a passage that described the despair of hell. And I was very imaginative, had a very good imagination, able to visualize things very well. And really in that moment, really went to that place that was described in the Bible of just this black, cold, lonely despair for eternity. And my eyes were closed and I was thinking about it and came out of it just visualizing that, crying and thinking about my dad, about how he would be there if he didn't change. And I know a lot of members might not believe that in their more nuanced faith, but as a boy, hearing that homosexuality was a sin, knowing that my dad was gay, that he had known the church was true and that he turned away from that, and then also knowing that I was born as his son for a reason,
yeah,
was really, I believed that he would be at that time, that he would go to hell if he didn't repent. And so I prayed really hard after that, in that experience, in that moment, and asked God to give him a final, at least one more solid chance at returning. And I felt a promise that that would be given and that I was to be central in that. And so that did, that responsibility to my father's soul really affected the way I approached religion after that. And I became more and more invested in the church. And I studied and prayed and all those things because I enjoyed it as well. It was satisfying and fulfilling. And I enjoy still thinking about deep things, but behind it all was also this responsibility towards my family.
Yeah. And were you sharing this with your mother or was this an absolutely personal thing?
I don't remember how much I talked about that experience. I might have talked with my mom. We were very open about those kind of things. I know when I was 17, I fasted and prayed about it. My brother was on his mission, Nathan was, and I wrote him a letter and talked to him about it. And we kind of talked about how important this was and what we were going to do to help our dad return, and fasted together and we're thinking about it at the same time. But that's about all I remember about that.
But meanwhile, you had a sort of a normal youth in your scouting and all that. Did you do all the Eagle Scout? And
Didn't finish the Eagle Scout, but, you know, as a part of that, I was just a normal kid other than that. Got in a lot of trouble and had fun, but, you know.
Not the big trouble, obviously.
The scouting thing, this might be a side point that isn't important, but I didn't finish the Eagle Scout. I remember one scouting ceremony. We were there, and my mom was there with me, and the scout leader said that without a father figure in the home, the chances that you would become an Eagle Scout are about half as much, and so the chance wasn't very high.
Okay.
So I didn't. We took that as a challenge at first, that I'm going to prove them wrong. My mom tried to help spin it that way, but eventually that was my excuse. It was, well, I'm not really expected to do it anyway. So,
well, I mean, in a way, just having a... I'm just guessing, but having a slightly out of mainstream family, I'm wondering if it didn't give you a slightly more open viewpoint, besides your just basic nature of being open to different people's view of Mormonism, or at least their lifestyle views, because obviously you were dealing with a gay father and a divorced mother and now a Reformed family. And so the rigidity that comes from growing up in the standard Mormon family that I kind of had, I'm just curious if it was different for you.
It did eventually. When I was younger, though, I was very Orthodox. I even didn't like some of the ways that my stepfather was expressed himself in his religious way. Like, for example, he sped, which was against what I was learning about honoring and obeying the laws of the land. So I was very strict.
Okay, so you were kind of dogmatic and judgmental in a way, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But eventually, as I matured, and especially when I went on my mission and then was meeting these other people, because I was so much in a bubble in Utah, I hadn't met people who lived another lifestyle very much, you know, and so.
You went to school first? Did you go straight on your mission, or?
Yeah, I went to a semester of college, or a semester or two, before I went on my mission. Just took general education, and I was younger in my age group, so I had to wait a little bit longer till I went than the rest of my friends. But
okay, which school did you go to?
Weber State University.
Okay, well, that was my childhood playground. I grew up a block away from there, so I have lots of memories of that, but none of them were going to school there. But anyway, so let's talk about your mission then. That mission experience obviously was pivotal in your evolution, so tell me about your thoughts about going on a mission, and then you're going on a mission, and tell me about your mission preparation and that. I mean, were you one of those teenagers who, you know, had your basic Mormon guilt, things like masturbation and pornography that's sort of ubiquitous in our society, or did those kind of guilt things kind of play a role in your life, considering that you were also carrying this load of having this huge responsibility?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the other things that drove me to become more religious than I might have otherwise been, was dealing with regular what is called immorality of masturbation before my mission. And so, but kind of quote unquote conquered that about a year before I went on my mission. I was very prepared for my mission as far as studying the doctrine. I had read the scriptures a lot, you know, I enjoyed, and I had studied a lot. The transition to a mission life was very easy for me. I was looking forward to it, and kind of the stereotypical, like, very excited to go on my mission, and also very strict with myself. I think Nathan and I were both very strict, had really high standards for what we wanted to do on our mission, which was part of all these promises also that we heard, that we were going to do these great things, both in our patriarchal blessings and just what was taught to us about what the mission was going to be like. So, but I was called to Illinois, the Illinois Peoria mission.
Uh-huh.
At the time, I wasn't really excited. You know, I would have been more excited to go to a foreign mission, but in hindsight, I'm very glad that I went to a stateside one, because I think sometimes with a cultural separation of being in another country, we don't learn sometimes as much from the people as we would if they're of our same culture, speak our same language, that kind of thing. And the greatest challenge that I ran into on my mission was And also the greatest joy was seeing people of other faiths and other lifestyles, not in the way that is explained to me as when I was young, but seeing their vibrance of faith, their, you know, sitting in their home and talking with them about the reasons they believed and the different way they interpreted the scriptures and all those things, and respecting that and coming to a more mature understanding of faith than I had before.
Now, I assume that when you went there, when you went to the MTC, this is also sort of a universal, or not totally universal, but a common thing where people just get there and they're just so gung-ho and so sure they're going to just go out there and save the world and then just want to give it 90 hours a week. And were you kind of running on that kind of a model, especially given your background thing of where you have this big actual responsibility to some real people in your life to be a success on your mission? Or did you kind of have that going on where you were really, really working hard or maybe harder than the other elders?
Yeah, I did. I'd say until about a year and a half into my mission, which was very emotionally difficult.
Did it even lead to conflicts with the other elders because they weren't working hard enough? Or were you kind of, did you get caught up in sort of that idea that you're being held back or you, it's hard to succeed and hard to be real gung-ho when you're this companion of mine just is lazy? Or
yeah, sometimes, absolutely. I think I would start every single companionship just really running as hard as I could, sometimes literally. I'll explain that in a second. But to get the momentum started right and to let them know that I was a really hardworking missionary and I wasn't going to accept any laziness or sleeping in or not leaving on time or all that kind of stuff. So everyone expected that of me because of what I'd do in the first few days of the companionship.
And you probably developed a reputation among the other missionaries for being hardworking and maybe a little driving, right?
Yeah, in fact, at one time in our mission, I adopted something that Nathan had done on his mission, which is called turbo tracting, and that involved running from door to door in order to save time. We got running shoes that were black and markless, brandless running shoes approved by my mission president.
So you could turbo tracked.
Yeah, turbo tracking. It was actually really fun.
Yeah, that'd be a good way to stay in good shape. Were you out of breath when you got to the doors?
Which was a fun challenge because you'd have to catch your breath and explain yourself at the same time. It facilitated us switching off often because you'd have to breathe while the other one talked. But
okay. Well, actually, I mean, that actually sounds kind of fun. Maybe I would have liked tracking more if I would have turbo-tracked. We had to run up and down stairs because we were in Montreal, but lots of stairs to get to people's front doors. But
it was fun. And, you know, I mentioned the difficult part of that high expectation for myself. I'm very much a planner. I like to set goals and set plans and go out to accomplish them. It's the way my mom taught me. She was she taught for Franklin Covey and taught about time management seminars and how to be our best selves and all this kind of stuff. So all this stuff's in my head, as well as the doctrine of the church around missionaries, which is, you know, I would read a quote from Brigham Young that said, you'll be responsible for those. I don't know if it's from Brigham Young or someone else right after him, but you'll be responsible for those you might have saved had you done your duty, which hit me not only as my dad, but, you know, in thinking about my dad, that I'd be responsible for that if I didn't do my best, but also people I'd pass that I didn't talk to. So we had this thing called opening your mouth, short term OYM on my mission. And they probably do it on a lot of missions where you try to just street contact, just random people that you're passing. And so you deal with this guilt of not doing it, you know, because you have this natural shyness, kind of awkward thing to bring up sometimes, religion randomly, and work it into a conversation with somebody at the gas station or something. But when I wouldn't do it, I'd feel guilty for it. And that was really difficult. So for example, towards the beginning of a transfer, we'd set goals for what the transfer was going to be like. And I was someone who had a lot of faith that God could help us accomplish anything. And so I believed the promises. And so we'd say, all right, with God's help, if we're obedient, we do this stuff, then we can get 8 baptisms this transfer. Or that was legitimately one of the goals we set, which in a context of faith is possible. So if we're open to the Spirit and we're being guided by Him, then He can send us to the right areas. And if we're teaching by the Spirit, then they'll be converted. And so then when that wouldn't happen, because I was in Illinois, I wasn't in Brazil, when that wouldn't happen, I would look for reasons, which is a healthy thing to do if you're trying to improve yourself in a business kind of way. But when you're relying on something divine to fill in the gap, then you assign the reasons for your failure to yourself. So why didn't we have that? Well, you know, I had this wayward thought, and so maybe I wasn't with the Spirit, or well, I felt that we should have gone down this road, but then we didn't. Well, we didn't track as much as we should have, or we didn't teach as passionately as we should have, or we weren't doing our personal study enough. In other words, there were always reasons to assign which were really difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
So it's very much not at peace, constantly striving to do better, but in an unhealthy kind of way.
So was this interrupted with some elements of joy or spirituality, or were you really just running with a lot of angst the whole time you were on your mission? I mean, this whole first part of your mission.
Yeah, you know, there'd be some days that were just absolutely perfect, and then those would be kind of the standards for the other days. And then the other days where you just didn't have that motivation pushing you, and those were difficult ones.
Okay.
There were really high times on the mission where everything was going great. About a year in, when I was in, you know, so I'm in Illinois. I'm right around the Nauvoo, Carthage. One area I was in was right across from Carthage, or from Nauvoo, and that was the highlight of my mission. That was when I was doing turbo tracting, and we had a lot of great things happen. But
and you felt inspired just being right there where the Mormon history was. That just really brought you back to, or really reminded you constantly of your divine connection to all of this, you know, or your predestined connection, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was really neat being that close to Nauvoo, and it also put us in straight confrontation with a lot of the anti-forces. So there was, you know, Rocky Hulse and other people who were going around to every church that was in our city preaching against it. So then we'd have to deal with that. So it was very fun because of that as well.
It gave a direct sort of opposition that was a fun opponent.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well then, what evolved? I mean, is there at some point in your mission something changed?
Yeah, the last 6 months of my mission were the most difficult, probably one of the most difficult times in my life, because I fluctuated in my testimony almost every day. So some days I'd be motivated and I would pray and I'd feel, this is the truth. I'm here because God wants me to be, and there are people out there waiting for this. And other days I would feel like God wanted me to leave the church and that this wasn't true. This was at the time of mission where I'd say I had become even more mature in my understanding of other people's faiths and their reasons for it. And a lot of the simplistic ways of casting out questions weren't working anymore. I was put into direct confrontation with these, with the anti, you know, the famous anti people of that area, but that wasn't necessarily it. It was little things. It was, I started to believe more in grace than I believed in works.
These things were coming out of your religious conversations with your investigators then. If you're thinking about grace and you're dealing with people in a place like Illinois, which are sort of middle American Christians, I'm guessing that the born again movement was probably a really big sort of influence, right?
Yeah, you had a lot of Catholics in our area, and you had a lot of, then the rest of them were evangelicals. Evangelicalism was big, and evangelicalism is very against Mormonism. The primary way is that they teach that we have a different Christ because we don't believe in grace, and we believe you have to do all these things to be saved. So that was a very common subject to come up. And I started slowly believing more in grace and rereading even the Book of Mormon, and the works doctrine that we have in the church just didn't make sense with the temples and with requirements for baptism and all these different ordinances didn't make sense in what I was reading in the Book of Mormon. Only in the late doctrines of the Pearl of Great Price, or the late doctrines of the Doctrine of Covenants. And so that was one source of it. And the other source of it, and probably the most difficult, was feeling like I was lied to by church authorities. And this is kind of a microcosm for what my whole mission in that last 6 months was like, was the last general conference that I participated in. I went into it fasting and praying and saying, I can't do this fluctuation thing. I'm willing to follow you, God, wherever you take me, but I just want to know which way is right. And because some days I would feel like he wanted me to stay in the church, and other days I'd feel like he wanted me to leave. So it was very confusing.
Can I put this in context then? Did you identify a moment where you actually had a spiritual confirmation that gave you a testimony, or was it just a summation of your experiences in the church that had made you sure, at least in the early part of your mission? What was your testimony foundation or formation? How would you describe that?
I had a lot of spiritual experiences, mostly reading the scriptures and thinking and praying. And like I said, this general conference was kind of an example of how fluctuative that would be. So I went into it fasting and praying in the first general and I said, just let me know what I need to do, leave or stay. First session, we're at a member's house, just sitting there in their living room on the couch and hearing all these restoration doctrines about the restoration and things like that. And I felt great. I felt fantastic and really felt that warm, burning feeling that this was true. And we went out after that general conference session, and we taught for the 2 hours, went tracting, and we had some great lessons. I still remember some of those lessons. It's pretty vivid. Then the next general conference session, the exact opposite. They touched on a lot of things that I didn't agree with, and primarily, and this was the hardest thing, was I listened to a talk, and I don't remember who it was by, that used a lot of scriptures that are in Preach My Gospel that attempt to show that there were restoration doctrines taught in the Bible times. And I had studied these scriptures and had come to nuanced and kind of vague ways of accepting them within the LDS context. For example, 1 Corinthians 13, or I think it's maybe it's 15, about the kingdom of heaven. Other ones, like other sheep I have, or, you know, other things like that, that I had interpreted in a vague way that still let me use, you know, accept those scriptures in a way, but I couldn't use them in lessons because it felt deceptive to me. So I listened in this general conference session to an apostle teaching using those scriptures in a simple way that was, in my opinion, extremely deceptive. And I felt, I kind of imagined myself as an 18-year-old boy sitting in that general conference, or as a 14-year-old boy in Utah in this bubble without any alternative interpretations available to me, and how much I felt driven by that and felt that this was true and this was our mission, and that this apostle was lying to us, that he had to know the other interpretations, but he was keeping it from us. So anyway, so in one session, I'm feeling great. The other session, I'm feeling extremely bad. And that was what the whole last 6 months of my mission was like.
Okay, but I'm curious, because when I was on my mission, I had this paradox in my head, which was that I can't really ask God if the church is true or not, because I'm not really willing to accept the answer that it's not true. So it sounds like your position was a little bit braver than mine, in that you just wanted the truth right now, even if it meant it was going to turn your world upside down.
Well, yeah, eventually, because I couldn't come to peace with the other answers. So eventually I had to say, all right, just leave me out if that's what I need to do. But I do remember many times I would try to justify the doubts I was having by, and this was my hope, is that those doubts were just there so that I could gain a stronger faith. And so the idea was, I can't really know the church is true until I go through this doubting period. Uh-huh. And I was hoping that's all it was. And it'll go away once I resolve these.
What about your quest? Once again, this background noise about needing to save your father and needing to save your family, and that you were destined for this. How was that impacting? Were you sometimes interpreting these doubts as being inspired by Satan to try and lead you away from that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that would be most of the dialogue that I had in the first part of my mission, and even in the first, you know, in the last 6 months. Eventually, you know, so going forward a little bit, when I left the church, I became evangelical for a while and just started going to non-denominational churches. And my hope was this, being able to be a part of a more liberal faith, would help me bring my dad back to Christ, even if he couldn't have the church. That maybe the reason he hadn't come back was because of all these problems in the church, but if he can just have Christ, then he can still be forgiven and whatever else.
Yeah. So you still, even initially after you left the church, you were still hanging on to this thought that you were still supposed to save your father, but you applied it to a different context. But let's go back then to the mission. I mean, how did it end up then? Did this really start to be a barrier to your performing in your mission, or to your staying there? Or
yeah, I did stay. I finished the mission, and most of it was, you know, outwardly I looked like I was completely fine. And
because you weren't sharing this with your companions, these doubts, or you weren't having real heart-to-hearts with investigators where your companion would figure out that you were sympathetic with their viewpoints, or?
No. Yeah. I did approach my mission president one time. The problem was that I would, and this remained a problem afterwards too, is that I would have these doubts in these days when I would feel this way, but then it would get better and I'd feel good for a while. And so when I approached my mission president, it happened to be after I was feeling good. So yeah. I couldn't really express to him what I was going through. And so the answer he gave to me were pretty surface level. But so no, I never really expressed this to anyone else while I was out there.
Uh-huh. Okay. But meanwhile, you're obeying all the mission rules. You were still working like pretty hard. I mean, did it get in the way of your, you know, high motivation, tracting, turbo tracting, or that kind of stuff?
Only motivation. It was difficult to talk to people when I didn't know really what I was going to say to them.
Yeah.
And definitely my effectiveness as far as just as an LDS missionary. One time, you know, just a quick example, we were in an investigator's house. It was a family. We were only teaching the husband, though. The family was Catholic. The husband was going through some problems, and he looked at us and he said, and missionaries have been teaching this guy for like 8 months or so. He looked at me and he said, just tell me the church is true, if the church is true, and I'll join it. And that was more difficult to me than anyone confronting with problems about the faith. So an anti-Mormon person could have given me problems and I could argue with them all day and that would be totally fine. This man totally trusting us and saying, just tell me if it's true and I'm going to make this change, when I knew how difficult that change would be on his family, and I couldn't say it. Couldn't say what I could have said at the beginning of my mission, which is, I know this is true. Let's do this. Let's set the baptism date or whatever. All I could say was, I believe this is true based on the way I feel. And if you pray about it, God will answer you whether you should do it or not. So it was very, very vague kind of.
Yeah, which is an okay answer, you know, which is what we're supposed to be saying anyway, but I guess the believe instead of know is certainly a distinction that Mormons typically find very different in their powerfulness. At least that's our perception, right? The one we're taught to bear our testimonies. Yeah, so why don't you just continue with how things evolved then with your mission ending and moving on after that?
So I got back from my mission and the same pattern of fluctuation continued, and I would feel confident about the church some days and then really unconfident later. So I approached it in what I thought was a healthy way, in that I started opening up conversations with people who I had read about on my mission, who I wanted to talk with. So, for example, I had read a book called How Wide the Divide by Stephen Robinson. And
say that again, How Wide the Divide by Stephen Robinson?
Yes, and Craig Blomberg. It was a conversation between an evangelical and a Mormon.
Uh-huh.
They addressed four doctrinal topics in very honest and frank ways, and I really liked that honesty and gravitated towards those kind of people instead of towards the more apologetic approach of Mormons dealing with difficulties of the church. So I met with, afterwards, there was a book written called Bridging the Divide by Robert Millett and someone else who's an evangelical. So I met with both of them. I met with Robert Millett. I met with the evangelical who had spoken into it. I went to the evangelical's church for a while. Also met with some people on BYU campus. I was living there for a while in an effort to understand homosexuality, and we can talk about that maybe more in a minute. But I put myself in a lot of contexts where I could try to not just suffer under the pain of this fluctuation, but try to get more perspective from more mature people than myself. So that was the good move I made. I was also in a relationship. There was a girl who had waited for me, who I had dated before my mission. And so the way that this fluctuation expressed itself in our relationship was that on times when I'd be doubting, I would be quiet about it, just like I'd been on mission. I didn't express a lot with her. I did eventually talk with her about it, but for the first part, I didn't. At times when I'd be faithful, I'd be very confident and happy about the relationship and everything like that. So I got engaged on one of those weeks where I was confident about it. So I was engaged within a couple months after getting back, and then finally left the church 3 months after getting back from a mission.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this process after your mission was 3 months. You just did a really intense sort of personal inventory and personal investigation, and this relationship was also a factor in your life decision at the time, so all within 3 months.
Yeah.
So how did it end out then?
It was incredibly difficult in that time period. You know, if you had been living below me in my split-level apartment, because it was two stories, you would have heard, you know, one day just kind of yelling, screaming that I needed clarity and that I didn't have it. And just after watching another conference talk by somebody, and extreme fluctuation. But anyway, eventually it ended where I went to church in a singles ward with my girlfriend or fiance at the time. And everything that I didn't believe in was talked about at the church, temple stuff, you know, various different things. Everything that I didn't believe or that I was having doubts with. And so we went home in the car and stopped, and I just said, you know, I realized today that I will never be able to make myself believe those things again, no matter how much I try. And so that was the end of it. Called my mom.
That was the end of your belief, or that was the end of the relationship, or both?
That was the end of both. That was when I finally allowed myself to give it up completely and move on to the next chapter.
But just a second. So this relationship was absolutely dependent on you being a member of the church. In other words, there was no possibility of this relationship if you were outside of the church.
Yes, we still kind of dated off and on for about a year. But some people hear that and they're like, oh, that's so terrible that the church teaches people to do that. But it was also me. I didn't really want to be in a split faith relationship for kids or whatever. And I wanted to have the freedom to think whatever I was going to think without having to think about how it would affect the person who I was with. So yeah, in the end, yes, it was completely dependent on me being in the church.
Okay. Then just talk a little bit about how you're about to talk about your mom and your family reacting to that. And then when you do that, I'm going to start talking to Nathan about and get him to sort of his faith crisis. Then we'll talk about those intervening years a little bit.
After that conversation with my fiance, now ex, drove up to the mountain and called my mom. And her reaction was fantastic. My faith crisis was unexpected. Nobody had any perception of what I was doing, that I was having these doubts, because I didn't open up to it with people other than acquaintances who I had talked about a minute ago. So she didn't find it, she didn't have any expectation of this. But she just told me that she trusts me and that she believes I'm a truth seeker, and that if we believe Joseph Smith's story about him seeking for the truth and following it without following his answer, without even regardless of it going against culture, that we had to be okay with me doing the same thing. She was living in Arizona at the time. She drove up the following week to be with me, and we sat in this upstairs living kind of loft and talked for 3 days straight about these things. And she just said, I just want to understand. So just tell me what's going on, or what you're thinking and what you're dealing with. So in her organizational Franklin Covey kind of way, she mapped it all out, the mind map, and we just talked. And she just said that she understood and she trusted me, and that was a very good gift from her.
So she was able to, you know, this is actually not a typical Mormon response, but she was able to say that your personal experience, even though it doesn't answer her questions, she has to respect that you were being authentic and sincere, and that her job is to respect where you arrived. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, definitely.
And that is a really nice response. And possibly not very common, at least from most people I've talked to, including myself. So then I think this would be a nice time to go back in time, but from Nathan's perspective. And Nathan, why don't you go back and let's start with the beginning of your story, your childhood, your Mormon childhood, also your childhood with a gay father. It sounds like you might have had a little stronger bond just being a little bit older, but why don't you correct me on that and tell me.
Yeah, because of just a lot of the, you know, the pressures of what we were being taught in church and everything, I don't feel like, you know, my bond with our father was anything greater. I mean, our parents were actually divorced when I was 3 years old.
Okay, still pretty young then, yeah.
I don't recall a lot of it, to be honest. I remember very vaguely living in a home in Farmington and, you know, having everybody there for dinners. I remember the kitchen set up, but it's all very vague memories of actually having our father there. And then honestly, it skips just with small examples and things that were experiences with him visiting just once or twice a year until we finally started to communicate on a regular basis just so much later in our lives as adults. You know, just as kind of a history, just to kind of let everybody get to know our family and just where we were geographically. Before I was born, our parents moved out to California for my dad to pursue court reporting training. And I was born in Orange, California. Just 3 years later, our parents were separated and divorced. They had been working together, and everybody will hear a lot more about this, obviously, from our parents. But they had been working together and with each other to help my dad overcome his homosexuality for quite a while before then. In fact, for about 8 years, they had been working together to do that. But I was born in 1983. We were all sealed together in June of 1984 in, I believe, a temple near Los Angeles. I'm not sure which one. But our family was sealed. To me, I believe they were already actually sealed before that, but in June of 1984, I was sealed to the family.
Because during the process of your father dealing with homosexuality, there was a period where your parents weren't sealed or something while you were born, is that?
Yes, actually, I left this out. Our father, when he went to the bishop in California about homosexuality, He was excommunicated in 1982. So when I was born, he hadn't actually had his blessings restored. That didn't occur until 1984. And then shortly after that, they were all sealed to me. We were all sealed together.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Just that whole phenomenon. I was a Mormon all my life, and it never occurred to me that someone would be sealed to all of his kids, but then he gets excommunicated. And if one kid gets born while he's excommunicated, that kid is not sealed to the family.
Yeah.
Kind of incredible. But anyway.
I don't remember a lot of the details on that, but the way that my mother told me when I asked her was that the family was sealed to me, as if they were all already sealed together.
Okay. So anyway, you went through this super young. I mean, I probably don't even remember that, but...
Not much, no.
It was obviously a milestone for your family.
By the time I was three, they separated on Valentine's Day in 1987, and shortly after that, we moved back to Utah, where my mom got her job with Franklin Quest, and then eventually that job moved her down to Texas, which is where most of our childhood occurred. Jefferson and I were more teenagers when we moved to Utah, so we got the experience outside of Utah as well, which I think was really good for us. Our mom made every effort, you know, to keep us involved in the church while we lived there. We were in Grapevine, Texas, just a suburb of Fort Worth, in the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolis there. And, you know, we had a lot of opportunities, a lot of scouting trips. We had probably the epitome of the perfect home teacher. Rick Churchwell was his name. He visited us on a regular basis, essentially became a big brother to Jefferson and I, making sure that I did my home teaching. He became my home teaching companion when I got the priesthood, you know, ensuring that we were involved with scouting and going to the different activities at the church. So we had a really good experience there in Grapevine with the church. I would say there was a time that was a little sketchy for me because I wore suspenders, and I remember distinctly being made fun of and being called Steve Urkel. So for a period of time, I actually skipped everything but sacrament meeting and hid in our mom's car for the other meetings because I was afraid to be made fun of. But other than that, we had the typical upbringing,
yeah,
in the church, good attendance every week. The one thing I remember throughout it all, this was, you know, when we were initially in Texas, our mother remarried and divorced just shortly after that. I think probably only a year or two, she was married to our first stepfather. And so most of the time, we didn't really feel like we had that father figure there other than our home teacher who came along a little ways after that. But all along, I felt like I had to set a good example for Jefferson. And that's kind of what initially started me off becoming, you know, involved in the church while I was there. I went from kind of skipping classes to trying to set a good example from him to where when I was 14, just before we moved up to Utah, again, I was, you know, trying to be a good missionary and inviting friends to come over and have family home evening with us, and was really getting more involved with the church.
But you were internalizing this role of being the oldest priesthood holder, or the recognizing responsibility towards your younger brother, and...
Very much. And it wasn't really just him either. I remember distinctly feeling when I got the priesthood, I was the leader of our household in many ways. And I was responsible for taking care of my mother, my three older sisters, and then setting the example for Jefferson.
Yeah.
And it was kind of overwhelming at first, but I took it very seriously, not just spiritually, but also physically. I still, to this day, have a fear of home alarm systems because of our home alarm system in our house. I had to be the first one down to meet whoever it was that may be trying to break into our house. And this was when I was, you know, 12, 13 years old.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely felt the need to protect our family and keep a good example for Jefferson. There are some funny stories that I may run into later. They're kind of off topic, but if they fit, I'll share them about Jefferson and I. But,
well, please do.
Just, I guess, is kind of a background to why we've always been so close and always felt this desire and almost a need to support each other and to support the same ideas and work together to help other people. We were just always very close. From the time he was very young, he was the typical tag-along little brother, went everywhere with me, and I never thought anything about it for so many years. We were best friends. We did everything together, even though there was a 3-year gap.
Uh-huh.
My first fist fight was actually with my best friend, because my best friend wanted to ditch Jefferson on a trail ride through some trails by Grapevine Lake. Was not too happy about that and made my friend crash his bike and then proceeded to get in a fight with him. And that was kind of how our friendship always was. You know, even in the years where I was beginning to be frustrated by him tagging along with me, you know, he still came along and, you know, we still watched out for each other and just loved spending time together and exploring. We had the, you know, the type of childhood where we were granted quite a bit of freedom by, you know, our mother, not just in the things we got to do outside, but, you know, also in our thinking. And that led to what I'm sure we'll touch on later, you know, with regards to our father and our view of him. But we were just given so much freedom to explore and to have just what I still view as just the perfect childhood there in Texas.
Yeah.
Exploring the forests near our house and running through sewers to get to the other side of the freeway. We did so many weird things that I look back on that were just so perfect and just really became close through all of that. And it's led to later on, you know, when we were involved in the church, to supporting each other with helping our dad, which we can touch on later. But
yeah, but let's touch a little bit about on your experience with your father then as a child and as a teen.
Yeah, so the very first thoughts I remember having about my dad were that I knew he wasn't dating. When he would come and visit, I don't remember being bothered by it, but I just remember recognizing the fact that we never really heard personal details of his life. And I interpreted that as he was just living alone. He wasn't dating any women, and that's what I just assumed, because we never heard anything. I actually had no idea, you know, neither of us knew that he was gay until our mom talked to us before we headed out for a long trip to Utah to spend time with him. And the way that she approached that is a testament to our mom's, you know, maturity and the love and respect she still has for our father. I don't remember exactly how she brought it up, but I remember telling us that he was gay and that that's the reason, one of the major reasons they had been divorced. And I just remember the question that I asked after she told us about this. It wasn't, why would our dad do this? It wasn't, how could he be so evil or bad? It was, how could this happen to our dad?
Okay, how old were you at the time when you learned this?
I was 12 years old.
Okay.
And the way that our mother approached it was the same way she had approached so many other things in the past. She did not want to infer any sort of negative emotions about people when she was discussing things with us, and it included a situation that had been incredibly heartbreaking to her, and even, you know, a person, our dad, who she still felt very hurt by. And despite all of that, she still wanted us to develop our own, you know, our own opinion of our father. And so she, you know, every once in a while, she would talk to us about him again and just bring things up. You know, when we were younger, just because of the way she brought it up, I don't remember thinking anything about it. I don't remember caring. I don't remember it changing any of our behavior around our dad. We were still just as excited to see him. We were still just as willing to hug him and kiss him and be around him. We weren't afraid of anything. And I love it that our mom portrayed it that way, that she didn't allow us to develop any negative views of it.
Yeah.
She talked to us again before we moved to Kaysville. And this is before my sophomore year. So I was 14. Jefferson would have been 11. And she pulled me aside. I don't remember if Jefferson was involved in this conversation, but both of our parents graduated from the high school that I would be attending, which is Davis High School, the one Jefferson went to as well, in Kaysville, Utah. And she just expressed to us that both of our parents had graduated from there, and much of our family had, and that the Cloward and Wicker name would be very well known. A lot of people would know us. And she just wanted to reassure us in this conversation that people may judge us once they find out who our father was, but that we shouldn't worry about it. We shouldn't let it influence us. And particularly, we shouldn't allow those judgments to make us think that we'll have to, essentially, that we would become homosexual. She was worried that people might assume that about us because of our father. And so she had that talk with us and wanted to assure us that we didn't need to worry about it. And at first, when we moved to Hayesville, I didn't care about it. I was proud to say who our parents were. But that gradually changed as I became more involved in the church. As I learned more and more about the law of chastity, I developed a strictness, almost an overly strictness about, you know, the commandments and things like that. As I started dating, I would listen to the words of the leaders and apply everything literally, almost as far as, you know, any sign of affection on a date is inappropriate, you know, before a committed relationship, and that anything, you know, beyond quick kisses or just pecks was inappropriate before marriage. I took a very strict view based on what I interpreted the leaders of the church expecting of me.
Were you kind of like your brother, as sort of really inclined towards a strong guild about things, or?
Very much, yeah. I was still your typical teenage boy, you know, still found pornography like I assume most young men do.
Virtually all.
You know, still went to the bishop for masturbation. I was very strict with girls, and I always respected them. That was one thing that I never struggled with, because I took it so strictly, my responsibility to respect women and to not, to basically follow, you know, the Strength of Youth pamphlet, yeah, and those types of things. But my strictness with myself, as far as the law of chastity went, it actually kind of led to my first negative feelings about homosexuality, because the more I learned about the church and how terrible, you know, breaking the law of chastity was, the more I held myself accountable. And I remember specifically in a bishop's interview in which I was working on overcoming my quote-unquote addiction to masturbation. I was meeting with the bishop, and he read a quote by Spencer W. Kimball that completely changed my perspective on homosexuality because of how strict I was. And it was the one about how masturbation leads to homosexuality. When it's done in private, it evolves into like mutual masturbation and then total homosexuality.
And did you become convinced that was how your father became homosexual, and that you were making yourself possibly do the same by your masturbation?
It was a mixed feeling. There was a part of me that immediately dismissed it, knowing my father and just having spent so much time around him and viewing him as a good man. There was a part of me that dismissed it, but then the side of me that was heavily involved in the church and deeply committed to it really struggled with the fact that one of my leaders had said this, and I trusted, yeah, the leaders at that time. And so even though, you know, our mom had never made it out to be a bad thing, I had used, you know, Jefferson and I, just like all of our peers, had used the word gay in an assaulting way, you know, when there was a time period when everybody said, that's gay.
Right. They still do.
It never had a negative connotation for us. We used it just like everybody else and never thought anything about it. But that meeting with my bishop for the first time tied homosexuality with the law of chastity. And the side of me that was upset at my dad and kind of judged him for sinning was the same side of me that was so hard on myself for breaking the law of chastity, essentially.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so I started to view homosexuality in a negative light because of that. And I worried. I had the irrational fear, what I view now obviously is irrational, that I would become gay every time I thought about masturbation.
Yeah.
So it definitely impacted my view of my father. The more that I became involved in the church, kind of the peak of it before my mission was when I was told to read, you know, Miracle of Forgiveness. The bishop I was working with at the time had a rule that before you could pass the sacrament again, if you've struggled with masturbation in any form, you have to finish the Miracle of Forgiveness and obviously abstain from giving into the temptations again. And so I read it, and I read it, you know, very thoroughly, and it just frustrated me even more. The more that I learned about how the church felt about homosexuality, the more frustrated I became with my father, and the more I was afraid to let people know who my dad was.
Yeah.
You know, this time I was still a, you know, sophomore, junior in high school, and everybody knew our family. Earlier, I mentioned the history of my dad's side of the family with the pioneers and everything, and having the last name Cloward, our grandfather was deeply involved in the community there, opened a motel in Kaysville, had one of the first gas stations there that he owned. And so it came up on a regular basis. And every time after this meeting with my bishop and after reading the miracle of forgiveness, I cringed when they would ask if I was related to other Clowards in the area, because I knew the very next question would be, you know, who are your parents?
Right.
And so that was kind of the beginning of the strain in my relationship, you know, with my dad. There was a battle going on between the church and him in my mind.
Yeah.
And all the ideas that, you know, my mother had, you know, all the empathetic thinking that she had taught us growing up was struggling to overcome what leaders I looked up to and respected were teaching me.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I got closer to my mission age...
Let me stop for a second, though. I just want to throw in a commentary. I'm glad both of you guys kind of shared about this way the guilt played a role for you. Both your cases are particular because of your father and how this was playing out in your head. But on the other hand, it's not that particular within Mormonism, because masturbation, of course, is ubiquitous. I mean, every young Mormon does it, or if they don't, they're extremely rare, right? And
yeah.
But what doesn't happen is not every one of them goes to the bishop and has the bishop start assigning them miracle of forgiveness. And so you have sort of two categories of youth. You have the ones who aren't confessing it, and they're sort of internally feeling guilty, but sort of setting it aside or not learning to give it a big importance, these things, and sort of living with the dissonance. And there's those, like both of you, who had to go talk about it, and then it creates this, you know, huge drama in your heads because you feel like you've been so guilty of such a terrible sin. And I just kind of want to comment on that. Also, comparing it to the perspective of gay men, because gay men also have the same thing happen to them when they're in their youth. And you might notice in my podcast that I ask them about that. And their experience in a way is similar, but then they're, of course, tying it to their own homosexuality as being possibly the cause of it, or else just not resonating with that. So anyway, I just appreciate your talking about it candidly, and I just wanted to throw in this commentary about it, sort of from a mental health perspective, that is really problematic, that at least the way we had a masturbation approach to us in our generation, which your generation is different than mine, but it sounds like it was still being approached in the same way. I'm hoping it's a little different now, but I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah, I feel like I was on the tail end of the stricter view of it. On my mission, I actually pulled a President Hinckley 2 weeks into my mission and called my mission president, told him I was going home, that I wasn't doing any good, that I wasn't worthy. And he came and visited me. He's actually a relative to the president, Gordon Hinckley.
Okay.
My mission president was Alonzo Hinckley. And a very good man. When he came to visit me, he asked me, he said, "Why are you feeling this way?"
Wait, you wrote a letter to President Hinckley?
Yeah. Oh. Well, President Alonzo Hinckley, so Gordon B. Hinckley's
okay.
nephew. Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. So continue then.
Yeah, I called him and told him to come see me and that I needed to go home. And I just expressed to him that I had previously struggled with masturbation and that I felt too guilty about it to be in the mission field. And I fully expected him, because of the things that I had been taught before my mission and how strict it was, that he would send me home. But he kind of laughed. And he said, "If I sent every missionary home that came to me about masturbation, I wouldn't have any missionaries."
Okay.
And that was...
That was the first time you'd had a normal message about this.
That was the first time I really realized I might not be such a terrible person for this.
Yeah.
The age of 19, that's the first time.
Okay. But before we go on with your mission, let's just make sure we tie things up about your teen and experience, your pre-mission years, and... You know, that you, this developing shame about your father's homosexuality, and this, I suspect it also impacted your visits with him, even though they weren't that often. You were still having some contact with him that I guess was impacted by your new perceptions, or these new perceptions of that were kind of more judgmental based on the messages you were getting, right?
Yeah, it became, you know, there was an awkwardness to the visits from my perspective. By the time I was 17, I was very dedicated to preparing myself for my mission. I actually graduated high school when I was 17, and so I was in that age group post-high school where everybody was preparing, and I just happened to have a year and a half to do it. So while he visited after high school graduation I was studying the scriptures every morning for an hour and a half. I was obviously praying. I was fulfilling callings in the church and, you know, doing all the things you would expect of somebody preparing for a mission. And when he would visit, because I was so dedicated to being as worthy as I could, little things that we had done before, I wouldn't participate in. Different things on Sunday, I would awkwardly tell him I couldn't participate. At one point, you know, I remember a specific instance in which there was a rated R movie that was rented. I believe it was Sleepy Hollow. We, him and my three sisters and Jefferson and I were watching it, and I knew it was rated R. I felt terrible about it, and eventually I stormed up the stairs. I don't know if I stormed. I just remember thinking that.
Yeah.
But I made a show of my dislike for what we were doing and walked upstairs, and I think Jefferson came up with me just a few minutes after that. But there were many situations like that. I knew that my dad was having to kind of hold his tongue because of how, you know, dedicated I was to the church and to being, you know, a good Mormon. And
yeah.
And so there was a bit of a strain. It wasn't so much direct. It was never really discussed, but it definitely did impact, you know, how I related to my dad and reacted around him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was a lot of the same feelings that Jefferson mentioned earlier. You know, our family from a very young age approached us on multiple occasions. You know, his siblings, our cousins, and our aunts and uncles approached us and told us, you know, that they were so proud of us and they knew that we would be the ones that saved our father. We would be the ones to bring him back. And so there was so much of that going on in my mind that though I was somewhat upset by the new, you know, perspective I had from the church, a lot of my energy was going towards preparing to discuss things with my dad and preparing to be a missionary to him. And I never got to that point. I never got up the courage to talk to him about it before I left.
Uh-huh.
In fact, he came to my mission farewell, and he was very supportive, very supportive. He served a mission in Italy. He was very excited to hear mission stories.
Did he support you financially?
I don't remember. I know I had saved half of the amount for my mission, and the rest of it was taken care of.
He told me he did, so I just thought it was interesting. In case you...
I'll have to thank him for that in retrospect, because I didn't know.
I should skip it, but I thought, anyway, let's just go on.
Okay, yeah, that's funny.
But anyway, he was interested in your mission. He wanted to know your mission stories.
Very much. He wrote me, you know, just as often as anybody. And, you know, I was called to the Seattle mission, which also put an interesting twist in my relationship with him because of the homosexual population in Seattle. I shortly after arriving there, you know, I decided I needed to send him a letter and ask him directly what had happened. And as I remembered and was thinking about this experience, it was really sad to me to see the impact that my, you know, the church leaders and some of those quotations had on my view of my dad, where when my mom first talked to me about our dad, I had asked, how could this happen to our dad? When I sent him the letter, I remember it being fairly abrasive, and I asked questions like, why did you do this? You know, why did you leave us? And then I transitioned into, will you ever consider coming back? And I basically told him that, you know, I deserved to know why he'd done what he'd done. And there was a lot of frustration in that letter. And though I feel terrible about it today, it was kind of the starting point of my communication with my dad about his life. And I don't know if he felt the frustration in that letter. I don't remember if he felt my anger at his decision and all the things I was feeling, but I just remember feeling very upset about it. Kind of leading up to that letter, being in Seattle had further bolstered the negative view of homosexuality that I had started to pick up in the church. Just a couple weeks before I arrived, the Pride Parade had taken place in downtown Seattle, and the mission was just buzzing with stories about those who were serving in the downtown area and how quote-unquote gays were approaching them and propositioning them. And looking back on it, most of that was probably just made up. But I just remember one particular circumstance, kind of giving a shout out to Boyd Packer. I told one of my companions that I would physically harm any gay person who propositioned me in my 2 years there. And it feels so weird to say that, but I remember saying that, and it was 100% supported by a current general authority.
Yeah.
And that was kind of leading up to that letter. I had met so many gay individuals there. You know, I was an avid door knocker. You know, we were required 2 hours a day in my mission, which was a lot less than I expected. I kind of went into it expecting to be knocking on doors all day. And so that's kind of what I did. By the time I was out for 6 months, I was called to be a trainer, and I didn't know what else to do. And so we knocked on doors, and we turbo-tracted.
The famous turbo-tracting.
We did the same as what Jeff did, you know, got some black tennis shoes approved and ran door-to-door. And, you know, in Seattle, I met so many gay individuals and couples. And I remember distinctly meeting couples who had children, and I was so bothered by that at first because of what I had been taught. And I was bothered probably mostly by the fact that they were very protective of their children around us. They were protecting their children from the missionaries, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't understand it. We were supposed to be the good guys, and they didn't want us to be around their children at all. So that's kind of the background leading into the letter that I sent him. And he responded very quickly. He told me that he expected a letter like that from me someday. And he handled it so well. He told me about his childhood, sharing stories about how he always felt more comfortable around girls. He preferred things like singing and riding horses to baseball and hunting, which his family, they're such big hunters. They, you know, they had horses. His older brother has an entire game room. It was a big part of their family, and he never liked to take part in those things, things that you would traditionally view as more masculine. And so he shared so much of that. And I, to this day, I wish I had kept that letter. I don't know if I misplaced it or I lost it, because I wanted to find it for this, but I just recall, as I read it, the return of so many of my original feelings about homosexuality, that my dad was a good person, that it wasn't a terrible thing, what he was doing, that he had been experiencing it from the time that he was less than 10 years old, and how could that possibly be a choice of his? So
this came back to you and your mission, that the empathy came back to you, but in this particular context. And so I'm just curious, how did you relate that then to your Mormon experience and encountering these gay people there? Did that change things?
Yeah, I started viewing them with so much more sympathy, just from hearing a lot of his stories and just feeling the heartbreak, especially when he told me how much regret he had for not being himself and for not allowing himself to live the way that he was born. And then to hear him say that he would never take any of it back. He'd never take back any of the pain or the mistakes or the loneliness because it brought him five beautiful children. It was really heartbreaking for me to hear that from my dad and to know that I was the product of a lot of pain on the part of two individuals, you know, my mom and our dad. And so from then on, I started wondering what the gay people I met in Seattle had been through themselves. Because it was obviously not a popular decision they had made, if it was even a decision. I was very conflicted about that view towards the end of my mission. And so I sort of adopted the view that most of them were not born that way. I still didn't eliminate the possibility that experience could lead to it, but that perhaps, and it's more of kind of where the church is headed today, that it was natural and that they still had a choice. It was still a commandment not to be homosexual or give in to those temptations, and so they still had a choice. So long before that kind of caught on in the church, that's how I felt internally.
Let me rephrase that then. You started to believe that, this wasn't a choice, that they had this struggle, in other words, that the homosexuality wasn't their choice, but their choice was whether they acted on it, which is kind of the current...
Exactly. The old saying that it's just like any other... tendency is the word that was always used back then. Somebody may be born with a tendency towards alcoholism, but that doesn't mean they drink. That's kind of the view that I started to take on it.
Okay, so which is arguably a little more empathetic than telling them that they chose this, right? So
yeah,
you're a little bit ahead of the church because you had an experience which is with a real-life person who told you their experience and you understood it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It really helped me feel better, you know, about my dad, and it was kind of the beginning of my transformation, I guess. The biggest step, and what I kind of have to view as the biggest step in the changing of my views, both towards the church and towards homosexuality, was probably the day that I was injured on my mission. I was actually only out for about 13 months when I blew out my knee on preparation day. I tore my posterior cruciate ligament and my medial ligament as well. I was sent home for surgery and went into like in-depth study of the human body, specifically, you know, the knee joint.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to learn as much as I could. I went back out onto my mission, but then was sent home a final time because of complications in my other leg.
Okay.
Yeah, so because of just how much I had studied my own knee ligaments and my injuries, I decided I really did have a passion about science, particularly human biology and physiology. And so I entered the zoology program at Weber State.
Let me just go back a little bit, though. So how much of your mission did you end up serving?
I was there for 13 months the first time and then only about two and a half months.
Okay.
The second time.
And how was this decision made that you wouldn't finish your mission?
It was not made by me. I actually left both times that I came home. I left most of my luggage and my things in Seattle. And the second time I came home, I had done the same. I had left everything out there. And my doctor, you know, my mother was very supportive, but at the same time very concerned because I was so dedicated to getting back. And she knew how much I spent time walking and running, and so she was very concerned. So she talked to the doctor while I was there and said, is he going to be okay to go back out? And the doctor right then said, no, his mission is over. And I guess also in the meantime, my mother had contacted my mission president and had just asked him, you know, what he felt like we should do. And he said, if this was my son, he wouldn't have come back the first time. And so it was kind of multiple things, but
was this a big blow that you weren't able to finish your mission?
Oh, yes, very much. I had many people that I was teaching at that point. I was currently serving in Kent, Washington, was having a very good experience. Though I will say it was harder when I got back than it was the first time I got there to get back into the missionary work. But I was so dedicated to serving an honorable full-time mission, like they always say, and I didn't want anything to get in the way of that. And so not only was it a blow to that, but it also, you know, it eliminated the potential for a lot of things that I had looked forward to. In high school, I was very involved in athletics and was looking to be on the Weber State track and soccer teams. And so it eliminated the potential for that as well.
Okay.
So kind of on both points, it was difficult for me. My mom, you know, she told me later on that she had such a hard time because of how dedicated I was. She felt like if I told her, or if she told me that I should stay home, that I would, because of how strict I was with myself, that I would tell her she was essentially being a bad influence on me. She worried about that.
Okay.
Not that I would have ever said that to my mom, but that was one of her concerns. So it was very difficult, and it was awkward for a long time, because once I got off crutches and off, I stopped using a cane, people would ask how old I was, and I was still only 20 years old. And there was an immediate, you know, in wards in Utah, there was an immediate question, well, what happened? I wasn't showing any signs of injury, obviously, and so it presented many awkward conversations at first.
Yeah.
And I made a joke out of it eventually, telling people, you know, that I was sent home because I was a bad missionary or things like that. But it was interesting to see the immediate reaction there in Utah.
Yeah, no, that's an intense stigma.
When they found out that a 20-year-old was home from a mission earlier.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.
Fear not.